is episode 7. I am Connor, and this is Fenn.
What's happening, everybody?
We want to give a quick shout out. Our walk-up music was made by U235 of Luscious 235. Their debut album, Endgame, is available. You can get it on all streaming platforms, but you can also purchase it. So maybe you want to go to iTunes. Also, we'll have a link up on our when we tweet about the show, we'll have a link up to where you can buy it as well, because you can get this album on vinyl, and that's pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
And then, you know, before we start as well, a friend of ours and a great guy, Lance Cooper of Save Flint Water Challenge at Escaped Matrix on Twitter. He's actually had a lot of support from like really cool people like Chelsea Clinton and Ben Stiller and stuff like that. So he's had like he's got like a lot of momentum. He's raised a lot of money. He's done a lot of stuff, but he's dreaming really big and he can use a lot more help. So if you've got a few bucks, that's great. If you can just share it and pass it on, that's also great, because one thing I think is if you share it enough times, you never know who it's going to reach. You never know who that's going to get to, and it could make all the difference. So, you know, I think sometimes people like we feel like, oh, if I don't have the extra few bucks, I don't want to touch it because I sort of feel guilty or I feel bad that I can't fully involve myself. But you know what? Hitting retweet is actually is more of a big deal than you think.
Use your voice.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's what we're doing. You know what I mean? That's true. That's what we're doing.
And what are we using our voices for this week?
Well, Connor, you know, this I got a big old smile on my face because it's a meaty one, I think.
Yeah.
You know, this government shutdown shit show is just ridiculous. And it got me to thinking, because really you're not hearing anything from the politically conservative side of the aisle about this. And you should be, you know, and because it's responsible governance. And I was thinking about why you're not hearing anything about it, you know, and tracking back to all the things that I've read about conservatism over the years. And I think I've come up with a pretty good reason for it. And I think it's backed up by a lot of things that it is backed up by a lot of things that I've read over the years. And I kind of wanted to talk about it.
I'm so into this. All right, let's do it.
Cool. So before we start that, there's a thing I wanted to say, just a little bit of base information about conservative political philosophy. I don't know if you've ever mentioned it, but you and I tried to do a show on this and it was like an hour long, so we trashed it. So yeah. It was brutal. It was brutal. It was hard. And one of the core the reason conservatism was started in America was a direct backlash to the New Deal of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They thought that it was way too much government overreach. That's what they said it was, at least. I am at a point now where I don't know if I believe Republican Party messaging at all anymore, past maybe the Gilded Age, you know, when they figured out that people didn't want, you know, corporations running their country. But they were still in bed with them, so, I mean, I don't understand, but...
Yeah, I've heard some strong arguments, and I've seen some strong arguments that objections to the New Deal were, a lot of those objections were about, you know, the people that would be included in that New Deal.
I think that it was mostly about winning more elections.
Okay.
Over the years, I've come to believe in my heart that the Republican Party concentrates more on winning elections than it does actually governing, which is interesting because one of the things I wanted to say at the beginning of this lay down a couple of ground rules is it is a core belief of mine that those who hate government should not govern. Those who hate government should not govern. And if you go further back from American conservatism to British conservatism as where it actually came from, like when you read The Conservative Mind, the first chapter is dedicated to the conservative movement inside the British government. So they like to say they harken back to that. And that's fine. They do. And what it really was a reaction against, in Britain, conservatism was a reaction against too much power held in the monarchy from the parliament. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the original conservative philosophy, was we don't want to give the king too much power, you know? Well, in America, after the New Deal, it turned into we don't want to give the government too much power, which in my opinion is anti-democratic at its core. like the whole point of conservatism was to maintain the freedoms that we enjoy in this country, drawn from maintaining the freedoms against the king in England, right? Right. Well, there's really no against the king here. The government is us, you know? If we collectively decide that we shouldn't have the freedom to buy firearms anymore, we've collectively decided that. That's not taking away a freedom. That's democracy.
That's exercising freedom.
Exactly. Exactly. So if you come at it from that place, that to me is a core difference between liberalism and conservatism in America, is that conservatism, the end result ends up being a small group of elite running the country.
There's a couple of big things that come to mind. Like, one is, you know, we're not going to do the whole gun thing right now.
But
like, if five friends are sitting around and they have a talk about, should we get Japanese food or should we get pizza? And four of them vote for pizza. Usually the other friend doesn't go, I have no freedom. Like, why does nobody respect my freedom? Why don't I have any freedom? Why are you taking away my freedom? The friend just goes, oh yeah, well, we decided on pizza, you know?
Democracy.
And that particular attitude always blows my mind, that like, just because you want something doesn't mean that everybody else wants it. And if enough people don't want it, then it shouldn't happen. And that's like, it's like, I feel sometimes like there's the reasoning of a toddler, you know?
Brother, I would say that's just living in a society.
Yeah.
Like, you go anthropologically back to it, there's a reason it's illegal to kill people. Because at some point, most of the people decided, hey, we probably shouldn't be okay with this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's not taking away a freedom. I mean, if you were to take that to its logical end, then you should be free to kill people. Which, yeah, interestingly, is kind of where the conservative movement has gotten itself, with guns. You know, you talk to a lot of gun guys and they'll be like, well, I just want to be able to kill people, you know?
Yeah, I want to have the option.
Yeah, that's not freedom. That's that's oppressing other people. But that's a whole other discussion, because we wanted to relate this to the shutdown.
Let's do it.
Okay. So we've got our core, you know, philosophies down, like that I personally believe that this is an anti-democratic way of going about government. And it is, because if you don't have the government to lean on to make people's lives better, the only other entity in America to lean on that has even an 82nd of the power of the government is the private sector.
Right.
Well, the private sector are corporations now. I mean, maybe in the 1930s, when it was still small businesses everywhere and GE wasn't a giant, and I always pick on GE for some reason, or Boeing wasn't a giant or whatever, you know, and now it's, yeah, Google and Facebook, you know. But if these corporations, you know, back, yeah, it was small businesses, and you did kind of want the government to not lean on them too hard because you wanted them to flourish. But when you roll it over to, they get so huge that they start coming into contact with the same power levels as the government collectively, like, and so that they're able to collectively buy into our government, mm-hmm, then it's a broken philosophy. Because really what you're trying to do is constantly deregulate these businesses so they can flourish, but they don't need your help to flourish anymore.
Yeah.
They need to stop them from flourishing in some cases, you know? So if you have a government that's run on a conservative philosophy, that is to let corporations do, you know, like Reagan said, you know, like the private sector can do better and do anything better than the public sector can. If you have a government that's strictly on that level, and our government has been on that level for a long time. It didn't used to be that way with the Democrats, but Bill Clinton himself changed that. And his move to the center is what they refer to it as.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that?
Only a little. I've read some stuff about, you know, about how Clinton was almost a Republican president in 100 different ways. But actually, you know what? Give me something about it. Give me a tight 2 minutes on this.
I don't even need 2 minutes. The reality of it was, Democrats had been losing a lot of elections. Reagan had smashed them wholeheartedly. Jimmy Carter only ran the one term. And then they had, you know, Ford and Lincoln before that, you know. So they needed it. They were trying to win the presidency back, and because they hadn't in so long, you know. And Bill Clinton's idea at the time, the Democratic Party was more liberal, and the Clintons came around, and they decided, and probably other people, but they decided as the figureheads of it, that the party was too far to the left, and that they needed to move a little more towards the free market side to survive as a party.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not real sure that's a truth. It worked. I mean, it got Bill Clinton the presidency, and it got Barack Obama the presidency, because, I mean, he was, you know, a fairly corporate president, you know, as far as presidents go.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to compare him to, like, maybe Teddy Roosevelt or Franklin Delano Roosevelt or something, you know. As far as Democratic presidents go, he was a fairly corporate president. And that's because the Clintons moved the party further to the right than it was. Whether it was in the center or not, I don't know, that's up for debate. But it definitely moved from the more leftward positions to the right in the Clinton years, and it has stayed there since. I think that's what frustrates a lot of liberals, is that the party has not gone with the ideals that it had in people's memory.
Right.
And that's a bitter pill to swallow, you know? I think the Republicans are going through that right now, actually.
Yeah, it's tricky because there's, you know, I live over here. I live in the UK at the moment. So I'm looking at UK government and stuff. And there are things that even the conservatives here would consider normal that would be considered too left wing for like a Democrat to run on, you know? And that's weird. Like the conservatives, though, are, I don't suppose they consider it normal. They respect it because they know they can't get away with changing it yet. But then in some ways, the conservatives have done things here that the Republicans haven't even stooped to. So I guess it's,
yeah, they have.
There's back and forth, you know. But yeah, the Democrats aren't, like, they're not as far left as they seem to be. Like, policy wise, they're never as far left as the things they say. And certainly in my lifetime, it feels that way.
Well, definitely, this is a both sides thing. Neither party is as far to the right or left as their base wants them to be in America.
Mm, okay.
That's the truth of it. I mean, we've talked about how the Republicans ignored their base for so long. The Democrats have done the same. I mean, they have. They've ignored their base for years and years, you know?
Because they're chasing this other base. Like,
yeah, right? They're chasing the middle instead of listening to their base. Which, it's also, interestingly, most of the policy proposals that Republicans refer to as radical left are supported by a majority, or at the very least a plurality of Americans.
Right.
And that's across the board. That's from sensible gun control all the way down to making the voting day a national holiday, fully supported by a majority or a plurality of Americans.
Education, healthcare, these are things that...
Yeah, all of them. And it's decidedly not conservative, you know?
Yeah.
So, well, why? And that goes more into, I mean, like, that's a Newt Gingrich thing, the radical left, you know, but we're not here to talk about Newt, because that guy sucks.
Uh-huh.
Oh, God, that guy sucks. And he just gets crazier by the day, but we're not here to talk about him.
Rotten.
Right. Well, okay, so the shutdown, right? Like, why are they not saying anything, you know? Because they want it that way, because they're so against government that they're cool if it's shut down. Like, as long as the people that are supposed to be at the top are making it happen, they're good with it, no matter how it happens, which means leaving 800,000 people in the dirt for a shutdown, that's nothing to them. They don't care. The only time they do care is if their constituents care.
Right.
So, like, you get a red state senator, you know, like this guy in Mississippi we talked about last time, or actually... this guy, I'm just going to use Mississippi as a representative example because it's a pretty good representative example of the South. Maybe it's a little further behind, but it's a pretty good representative example. I mean, this guy in Mississippi, this senator, he doesn't care if the government shut down because he doesn't really have a whole lot of constituents that are being affected by it. Actually, right. Mississippi's a bad example of that. There's a big port there, a big ship port.
Oh, okay. But,
maybe Alabama or Texas or something, you know, like John Cornyn might be a little afraid. But not really. I mean, Beto came within 3 or 4 points. Can that magic happen again? He's probably banking that it won't. And as a sidebar, in my personal opinion, that's a stupid bank, because there is a change in this nation. You can smell it in the freaking air. It's not just online. Like, I hear people talking.
You know, that's good to hear, because that's something I don't get. Because what I do get is, I have friends, you know, and I'm on Twitter and stuff like that, and I'm reading articles and stuff like that, but I'm not there, and I'm not hearing people talk.
There's a relative of mine who, when Trump came around, he said to me, I'm going to vote for a Republican. And I said, well, that guy's an idiot, you know? And he's like, I don't care. Republicans fix the economy. And I was like, there's nothing wrong with the economy.
Jesus.
And he's like, well, I'm not making as much money as I want to make, you know? I mean, it's a really good guy, you know? And he is a person who is in that middle, you know, that little 8% that sits around that 50% every time, you know, they talk about, you know?
Yeah.
He is one of those guys. He's not anymore. He's a Democrat now.
Wow.
Yeah, full on. He told me the other day, I'll never vote for a Republican again in my life, ever. Never, ever, 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 ever.
That's pretty reassuring, actually. Stories like that kind of make me feel better.
Yeah. So, and I'm curious to know, like, I wish that I wasn't down on the medical thing, because I wish that I was out and about working, because I would like to hear what the factory people I work with are saying, you know?
Yeah.
It might be the same.
Wow.
And I don't think that this shutdown is helping them, because quite frankly, when people start losing their tax checks, or like when people find out that, you know, Aunt Jo, who depends on SNAPs because she's 60 something, isn't getting her food stamps, they're going to be mad.
Yeah.
Now, that takes a little while to work into the zeitgeist of the public, though. That's right now, that's the political class on TV. They're calling it talking point stage. And I think that's a pretty good, pretty apt description of where it's at right now. It's sad because it's been 3 weeks, but that's what it is, you know.
And this is the longest government shutdown in American history, right?
We're like 3 days shy of that.
Okay.
Yeah. You know who owned the other one, don't you? The current longest one?
Who might that be?
That might be Newt Gingrich.
Oh. Our buddy. Friend of the show.
Yeah, a friend of the show indeed.
Yeah.
So what you have is, you have a bunch of people here who are not running the government because they don't believe in the government. The conservatism that they've come to is a place where they do need a supreme leader. They do think that the government is so bad, only one person can run it, or only one small group of people can run it. Those little elite, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if you read in the conservative mind, there's actually and I don't remember what page it's on or whatever, but there is actually something stuck in my mind that they don't even want they think that education shouldn't be squandered on the masses. That's a big reason they assault schools. They never say that, but if you read the conservative mind, there's like half a chapter on why the masses should not be trusted with an education. That's staggering.
It is. And I think that's common to, I was just blathering on a few minutes ago, but the difference is between, you know, UK conservatism and American conservatism. That's one thing that they really have in common. They don't really want regular people to be educated.
Right. It's an aristocratic way of looking at the world.
Mm-hmm.
And what fascinates me the most about it is that conservatism, in its rebellion against the aristocratic way of looking at the world, became the aristocratic way of looking at the world. We know what's best for you.
I mean, inherited wealth, generation after generation of elites.
We know what's best for you.
Yeah.
So, and I should also point out, that's funny, I should also point out, though, that in the early 1900s, the liberals of the United States were the "we know what's best for you" people. As a backlash to the Gilded Age.
Tell me about that.
Well, in the early 1900s, the liberal, I'm going to use the term even though I don't like it, but at the time, it kind of applies. There were liberal elite. They were rich people who were self-professed liberals, politically speaking. Mm-hmm. And really, charity was how, this was before, you know, the New Deal and the government safety net systems we had, you know. People had to depend on private charities to survive when they were 70 years old. You know, you couldn't work anymore. either your family took care of you or you were, you know, on the dole from some private charity or three right. or four. And they were mostly run by liberals at the time because the Republicans at the time, because they were really no true conservatives. So the Republicans at the time were the corporatists, you know.
Okay.
And they used a lot of the early sociological theories to say, we know what's best for you, basically, because they read more, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be just that simple, you know, not everybody read back then with extreme proficiency, you know?
Yeah.
But interestingly, because that goes back to the education thing we said, what bothers me so much about the conservative philosophy that we don't think the masses deserve education was two things about it. The first thing about it was that the reason they don't think the masses deserve education was because they think that we would misuse it. And that's in the book, man. It's in the conservative mind. I can't recommend it enough. That's really what it is. That's they think that it would be misused by the common man. At one point in that book, the common people are referred to as plebeians. So it's not very. Yeah, I mean, it really is like an aristocratic book.
Yeah,
it's very haughty, and it is the basis of modern American conservatism. It is the one to read if you want to understand it, and it's the one they all read too. The other side of that coin is we're the first nation in the history of human race to offer free education to every single one of its citizens. That is a legacy that we must keep at all costs. That's just my thought on that.
Okay, so we've often touched on this book, The Conservative Mind. You've told me about it over the time that we talked, and I think it's come up a couple of times on the show, but I still haven't read it. I'm sorry. And a lot of our listeners probably haven't either. Can you give like a couple of minutes on like when it's from, you know, what's its background and, you know, where it sits in the conversation?
Sure, sure. I'm not actually sure the copyright date of that book. I just know when it was started to be used as the, I like to call it the Bible of modern conservatism.
Yeah.
Modern American conservatism, but I guess maybe that's starting to spread across the world. So modern conservatism will do. It was originally used, it's written by a guy named Russell Kirk. He's kind of the founder of modern conservatism, a lot of people would say, that are in conservative thinker circles. Like maybe the guys that write for National Review or something, they would know this book almost by heart.
Okay.
And it's a treatise on the history of, like, it's where I learned that conservatism originally started in England, you know, and it's a history on that by an Irishman, interestingly.
Wow.
Yeah. And the first chapter or so is dedicated to that. And then it is I love the word treatise, but I don't know if it's the appropriate word for it. It expounds on how that conservative principle against the king and an overreach of government into the parliament applies to the democracy that we have in America. It is an enormously thick and dry book, and I'm just proud to have been able to read it once, even though
yeah.
I tried, you know. But it is like if you see someone on television who's like an actual conservative, you know, like I would say that Joe Scarborough actually might qualify as an actual conservative.
Okay.
And there are a few more every once in a while. And the funny thing is I think Joe Scarborough has become more of an actual conservative since Trump than he was before Trump. I think I could say that of a lot of conservatives, actually, that they realized something was amiss in their philosophy.
Okay. Well, so we've got our rule, right? We're allowed to have a Trump window. Obviously, the shutdown is kind of – this makes this a little bit of a Trump episode, kind of. But can you tell me anything more about that? Because that's really interesting to me about conservatives that are people that have become more or closer to the standard ideal of conservatism sort of in the wake of Trump.
Sure, sure, I can. I'll use the Bush years as an example. When after 9/11 happened, the Bush administration, to fix it, one of the things that, after the study, one of the things they figured out was that the intelligence agencies weren't communicating well together. And that's a whole other thing about rivalries of agencies. But they weren't, you know, and they created this huge bloated entity called the Department of Homeland Security. It's the largest, I think it's the third largest bureaucratic organization in the nation, maybe the second, but I think it's DOD, VA, and then Homeland Security, I think. It might be DOD, Homeland Security, and then VA, maybe. But they are, it's one of the top three largest. And none of these people that were conservatives when George Bush passed these huge tax cuts and then started these big spending programs for Department of Homeland Security, none of these people that were calling themselves conservatives cried out about it. None of them. Oh. They just went along with it, you know?
Right.
And it really, really, really set the actual conservative movement back. But I don't think most of them were realizing it at the time. Because now, then they see Trump and they see somebody they don't like doing what they don't like, as far as like cutting taxes stupidly and then wanting to spend a bunch of money. Now I think they're starting to come back to that fiscal conservative route, I guess would be a better way of putting it.
Okay. Yeah. That's really interesting. Because I've sort of heard some about, you know, like coming back into the fold kind of stuff about some of these guys, but I didn't really understand the context for it. That's good.
I think there are parts of conservatism that are kind of smart. Like, you don't want your government to waste money. It's your tax dollars. Nobody wants your tax dollars to go to waste, you know? And yeah. So of course there are little parts of conservative governance philosophy that are good. There are some. Why are there six agencies to, you know, regulate salmon usage? I don't know. That doesn't really make sense. It's right. Over the years, you know, different legislatures have put up different laws to do it, and that's where we get. And that is a bloated government, and a bit of conservatism could be used in that context. But in the overall context of anti-democratic, and we see it in the vote, like it's so anti-democratic now that we see it in the voting pattern or in the voter manipulation, things like that.
Yeah.
Or like what the legislatures in Wisconsin did, you know, that's anti-democratic. And if you don't respect the government, then it's easy for you to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, which comes back to kind of your starting point of if you think government is bad, you shouldn't be allowed to be in government.
You shouldn't be allowed to be running it, right, because you're cool with the shutdown.
Yeah.
Because you don't really like the government working anyway. It kind of, if you if you get in there and you're able to shut it down, doesn't that prove your point that the government sucks?
I mean, it's
I mean, that's really what it boils down to.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what we've been moving to this whole conversation, is that if you hate the government and you want everyone else to vote for you because you want them to hate the government too, then if you can shut it down and make it look incompetent, then you're getting you're creating the narrative that you want people to believe.
My big question, I think this is something you and I have talked about before. I don't know if we've ever talked about it on the show, is like, I often wonder with people, like, what is your ideal outcome, you know? And with that, I'm like, what is their ideal outcome then?
Same ideal outcome that any politician in a democracy has.
Be to re-elected. Hold on to power? Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you're constantly, here's why, like when you hear talking heads on TV say, who's responsible? That's why it matters. Like, they'll say, oh, well, did it matter then? Did it matter now? It does matter. It does matter because it's the narrative that you're creating. And if the narrative you're creating is that the government's incompetent, then you make the government incompetent. You cannot let the people that you're telling the government is incompetent know that you're the one that made the government incompetent.
Right.
So you have to blame it on, you have to blame it on the other side. And every time they've shut down the government, they've blamed it on the other side. They're doing it now. Democrats won't come to the table. They're trying it now.
Yeah.
The only problem is, and here's a bit more of our Trump minute, they got a blowhard at the top who don't get it.
Yeah.
So he's blowing open the lie, you know?
Yeah.
I think another reason that the change is happening in this nation, because the guy that's in charge of the party, and really a president is in charge of the party. Like when Nancy Pelosi said that it's not part of the Article I powers for them not to bring bills to the president's desk, she's right. But it also is the party's responsibility to follow their leader, and their leader, unfortunately for them, is Donald Trump.
Right.
So if he says he's not going to, you know, they can't embarrass him. Because if they embarrass him, he won't get reelected. Or well, at the very least, it'll lower his chances of being reelected. Then they won't have the White House again. They won't have the veto pen.
Right.
So it's this cycle of conservatives who don't like the government, shutting the government down, trying to blame it on the other side and not getting away with it anymore because they got an idiot at the top. Because
so,
gerrymandered themselves into stupidity.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking about that actually. This feels like a very natural extension of what we were talking about last week.
It is. The whole thing, everything we talk about is, you know?
So I guess to look at the ideal outcome thing, right? Because that always helps me to get my head around things. I'm always trying to figure out, like, well, what, you know, when people are doing stuff that I can't get my head around, I'm like, well, what, how, do, if everything goes out exactly as you want, if everything goes exactly, you know, to your perfect plan, what will it look like? So will it look like they remain in power, but the government itself is weakened and, like, democracy itself is weakened? Is that the ideal outcome?
I don't think that they think that's the ideal outcome, but democracy would be weakened. Yeah. I'm sure that there are plenty of conservatives who would say, no, I don't want democracy to go away. I want it to be like I want it to be.
Yeah. Again,
you know, we kind of have, that's anti-democratic on its own, you know?
Yes.
Like a responsible Democrat, a responsible citizen would say, I want it to be like we want it to be.
No, sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, that's it. No, that was it.
You know, not to get all, you know, not to go into the emotional side of it too much, but I think that the conservative mind is a fearful mind. I think that it's the common denominator across all these things, and also the things that always end up being linked to conservatism, like, you know, your sexism and your racism and all that.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, the desire to limit other people's choice is a fearful desire. It's a desire that comes from fear, because I think the progressive, the you know, the liberal hippie attitude, whatever you want to call it, is that, well, people will probably make pretty okay choices if we just give them information.
I agree with you're right. And we talked about it a second ago. We just didn't put the connection together. It started because they were afraid of a king.
Yeah. Right.
And then it became, they're afraid of our government. Because it's, you know, if the government taxes you too much, you can't use that money for freely like you want to. Like, one of the reasons they justify lowering the taxes is because it takes away your freedom to spend your money as you want, because they're afraid that the government won't spend it correctly.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. It's so funny to me, though, because, like, the definition of what is correct spending, the conservative definition of correct spending of taxes is so insane to me.
The conservative definition of correct spending of taxes is nothing.
Right.
Like, yeah. Realistically speaking, they'd want taxes to be basically nothing.
Don't collect any, don't spend any.
Yeah. That's not a government.
No,
it's just
not.
A bunch of people milling around. I mean, right? Seriously, though, right? I mean, not a government.
I mean, all right. I have an important question. Are there any points that we've missed? Because if we have missed a point, let's do it. And if we haven't, can we just end on, that's not a government, that's just a bunch of people milling around?
We haven't, and I'm so good with that. I'm so good with that.
Yeah, okay. All right, great. Well, listen, thanks a lot for listening, folks, as always. We'll say goodnight, but you'll hear from us in a week.
All right, bye, everybody.
Good night, folks.